Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Warning, this episode contains harsh language, graphic violence, gore, and descriptions of sexual assault. Listener discretion is advised.
I'm Ken Harbaugh, host of Warriors in Their Own Words. In partnership with The Honor Project, we've brought this podcast back at a time when our nation needs these stories more than ever. Warriors in Their Own Words is our attempt to present an unvarnished, unsanitized truth of what we have asked of those who defend this nation. Thank you for listening, and by doing so, honoring those who have served. Today, in a special episode, we'll hear from Command Sergeant Major Tanya Oxendine. Oxendine served in the U.S. Army for nearly 30 years, retiring as a command sergeant major. She did two tours in Iraq and Afghanistan as a paratrooper.
My name is Tanya Oxendine, and I served in the United States Army for nearly 30 years. I retired as a command sergeant major, Battalion Command Sergeant Major, leading over 1,500 soldiers. And I spent most of my time at Fort Bragg, North Carolina. It's now Fort Liberty, but it's where I spent most of my time in the 82nd Airborne. I grew up in some hard and unaccommodating situations. I didn't have anybody that I looked up to. Like I said, I didn't know anything about the military. I didn't have someone that, you know, said, hey, I'm in the military, join the military. It was nothing like that. A people around me like that. A positive people, so to speak. Later on in life, I realized that my uncle had served in Vietnam, but he was not around. I joined because we were poor. My mother was a single parent of me and my brother, and we were on food stamps, welfare. We lived in an old blue wooden house on a dirt road. It had no street lights. And, it was just a pretty tough situations. You know, a lot of times our electricity would be cut off, and until my mom could scrape up enough money to pay the electric bill, we would have to run a big, long orange industrial extension cord from, you know, our cousin's house, plug it into there, to our house with a little bit of light on the end of it. I call them the mechanic lights, you know, just so we can have a little light in the house. That's how tough it was. But I knew deep down in my head that I did not want my life to consist of, you know, food stamps and extension cords and the abuse and the fighting and all this stuff. I knew that from a little girl, because I had endured some things as a child, as a little girl, that no little girl should have to endure. I'll straight out and say, you know, rape. That's what it was. They can call it molestation, abuse, sexual abuse, and all this. It was rape. I mean, I didn't have a say-so in what the heck was going on to my body. So I knew that I was not going to stay there on that dirt road. I knew that I was not going to stay in St. Augustine, that I had to leave some kind of way. and I knew that although I wanted to go to college after I was in high school and that stuff, it just seemed like it wasn't an option for me. So one day I was just walking down the street, as I usually do, as, you know, just going over to one of my friend's house. And I kind of looked over to the left and, you know, saw these buildings and the recruiting station. It said military recruiting or whatever it was. And I walked over there, just duty, 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 lollygagging, and I walked over there and went to the first door. And the first door happened to be the Army. If the first door was the Marines, I would be a Marine, and so on and so forth. So the first door was the Army's door. And that's how I ended up joining the military. I was a sergeant first class when I went to airborne school, which is also a story within itself. No, I had no idea. I didn't know anything about rank structure, or, you know, what it entailed. When I, you know, it, don't remember everything, but by the time I left the recruiting station, you know, go back home, said, I'm going to join the Army, came in on the delayed entry program, you know, shipped off the basic training. You know, back then, I don't know how they still do it now, but they showed videos and they showed, you know, these different videos of what MOS you could choose and this type of stuff. And the one video that I saw was, it's crazy. They did a, you know, showed, you know, going through the mud and all this stuff and find your weapon and all these different things. And part of the video was this young lady had a really nice uniform on and she had on a skirt and this thing. And it looked just, I mean, I don't know, she looked so professional. And I said, well, I want to do what she's doing. And it happened to be, and it happened to be, you know, Adjutant General's Corps. So human resources. And so I got into that was my job, human resources, Adjutant General Corps. And then some time went along, went to some non-commissioned officer, educational schools, SOESs and that. And I saw this gentleman, I was in a mid-level course and this, the most handsome man I could ever almost notice, see, walks past or comes in the classroom during this training. And I said, damn, he looked good. He had this burgundy beret on and it was just, I mean, fitting just right. His uniform was, I mean, like they sewed it on him. Boots shining. I said, I don't know what he do or what he got going on, but I want to be a part of it. Come to find out he was in the 82nd Airborne Division. And after training, I put in my application, put in my packet to go to airborne school, went to airborne school as I think I was 30 something, early 30s. And went to airborne school. And I at that, and I wanted to be where he was at, 82nd Airborne Division. And his name was, last name was Prince. Hector Prince, I'll never forget that. And so that's how I ended up in the 82nd F1 Division. Yeah, so, you know, just it, again, just, you know, my childhood wasn't, you know, the best, so to speak, because of, you know, just because of the sexual assault and rape and all that kind of stuff. And I dealt with some of the same things in the military. Harassment and then a rape in basic training. And then some other harassment in some later years. But after I started making the rank and stuff, that stuff ceased to exist. And so then I was at a point where I could, you know, help some other people and notice some shit really quick off the bat. But, you know, it started when I joined in basic training. And I'll never forget, I was pulling CQ, charge of quarters, in the barracks. And yeah, and I was on, you're in the bays. You got these long hallways. And I'm on one end of the hallway and the other female is on one end of the hallway. And it's early in the morning. We have this early morning shift. I don't know, probably 2 o'clock, say 02, but about 2 o'clock in the morning. And we pull our shifts with your battle buddy. And drill sergeant comes up the steps. And we, you know, kind of wondering why, because they don't come in. They come in early, but they don't come in that early. So anyway, drill sergeant says, you know, you guys switch positions. And it wasn't time to switch yet because, you know, we would rotate and switch positions at certain times at the end of the hallway. One, to stay awake, but then just to, you know, that kind of stuff, right? So we switch positions. And again, the hallway is really long. So the other female, my battle buddy, she really couldn't see me on this end of the hallway by the drill sergeant's office. So the drill sergeant says, hey, Oxendine, come in the office. And, you know, he commenced to, you know, pushing me against the door and pulling down my BDU pants and raping me in the drill sergeant office. Now, went back out, did my job, never said anything for years until I retired, you know, because my job was important to me. And my job fed my family. And, you know, my job, it took care of me. And I knew that I had a job to do. So that took priority over, and I won't say my well-being, because at that point I didn't know or realize, like, you know, I'm suppressing this or I'm suffering and this and that. I just pushed the shit down because I had a job to do. I signed up to protect and serve my country. I loved my job. I loved doing what I was doing. And my soldiers and my career and protecting my country and serving my country was priority for me. My family knew it. My husband at that time, he knew it. That was priority. That is what I needed. So, and I think all those things that happened in my life as a child in the military, I think it just you know, as I suppressed it and put it away, I think it just propelled me to be better, to have the drive, the discipline, the character and the values that I have today. And I know it may sound crazy, but I wouldn't change that shit for the world. I really wouldn't. Now, I know nobody wants to be raped and all that kind of stuff, but I got broad shoulders. So I think that with those terrible things that happened to me, I used to be ashamed when at first I was starting to talk about it, but I'm not ashamed of that anymore. That is a part of who I am. That is who I am. I am a victim. We all are victims at some point in our life, whether it's through love, being hurt, whatever the case may be. And for me, it's about how I overcame that shit. Because right now I'm winning. I am winning at life. I live a wonderful life. I don't have but a couple of regrets over some things I didn't do. But I went through some tough stuff. And it has made me who I am today. And, a lot of things were important to me in life. And the Army was a major importance in my life. It structured me for who I am today to be able to deal with stuff. I was in mainly male-dominated units. I was a drill instructor. I was, of course, at the 82nd Airborne Division, being in those male-dominated units. And I was the only Black senior female in meetings or, with my peers and with senior leaders. And I was excelling in my career. But at times, I felt isolated because I felt like there was no room for error. I felt more pressure to succeed. And even though I had been, discriminated against, harassed, talked about, judged, those things happened. I think, I don't know why, but, for whatever reason, but my peers and leaders, nobody looked like me. I felt like nobody understood me or anything. So I put up this wall around myself, kind of like the Great Wall of China, to protect myself from, those people that treated me like that. And I said to myself, I don't need them. I can do all this on my own. I am an independent woman. I can take care of myself. So I put this wall up and, but that wall kept me isolated, just like the Great Wall of China kind of kept people isolated within, although it was built to protect them, but it kept them isolated. And my wall kept me isolated. And so then these wars, these internal wars, these mental wars came within. And it inhibited me from doing some things that I needed to do. Like, okay, they're my peers and my leaders. Why do I have this wall up? I can reach out and ask for help as well. I can go to them. I'm dependent on, I thought that I was, that I needed them to come to me, but I could have went to them as well. And ask for help in a mission, I'm talking about, to complete a mission or all this and not try to do it on my own. Because what I did learn from being in these type of units and being in male-dominated units and different things and what it has taught me and being a senior leader is that being independent for me was the wrong thing. I was too fiercely independent and that was wrong. And it almost cost me my life. So I had to learn interdependence that, I don't have to do this alone, that I can have my team, that we need other people around us to help us, to be influenced by others, to reach out and, like I said, ask for help or to go to someone and offer them an olive branch. And so I just had to learn that. And although some people did treat me badly, it was a lot of people that did not treat me badly and they had my best interests at heart. Just those few people, like the drill sergeant that raped me, just those few people, like a few senior NCOs or a few officers that may have sexually harassed me or harassed me. That's few. Those are the anomaly. I'm talking about the majority of people in the military were good to me. I had some great leaders. The military has shaped me to who I am now. And it's really reflected positively on my life. The military provided me opportunities for personal and professional growth where I was able to push my limits. It provided me a chance to become stronger, more reliable, and just more suited for life. I discovered strengths in the Army that I didn't know that I had. So I'm thankful for the Army despite the terrible things that happened. I am thankful for my childhood despite the terrible things that happened. Because at the end of the day, I still have to continue to move on and continue to lead And that's my whole, for my entire life, if anything, I've learned that leadership is a people's business. It's about taking care of people. Good order and discipline, all that stuff that comes with it.
Hello, this is Gary Chahot welcoming you to check out the French History Podcast. Our main show covers the history of France from the first humans until present. If you liked Mike Duncan's The History of Rome and wanted a similar program covering the land of beauty, culture, and love, we are exactly that. We also host world-renowned scholars who have delivered guest episodes on their specialties, including 18th century pirates, revolutionary booksellers in 20th century Paris, the special friendship between the Marquis de Lafayette and Thomas Jefferson, and numerous others. Learn what you love and listen to the French History Podcast today.
We often hear about the individuals who took the oath of office to become the chief executive. But what about the other people who play a role in each administration, or the events that may not be as well known, but that contribute to the reshaping of the office of the American presidency? On the Presidencies of the United States, we explore each administration beyond just the person holding the highest elected office in order to better understand the history that brought us to the modern day presidency. I hope you'll join me on this journey through the annals of presidential history. Presidencies can be found anywhere fine podcasts can be found, and is a proud member of the Evergreen Podcast Network.
Wow, you know, that last deployment, that was a pretty tough deployment. And that was a pretty tough deployment. You know, when I deployed to Iraq and Afghanistan, in Iraq, we lost a soldier of mine. We lost our Staff Sergeant Francisco Martinez by a roadside bomb. And that was tough on all of us. But Afghanistan was just really, really tough, man, you know. Well, you know, we had a great team. I tell you, my commander, Colonel David Leach, is just one of the best. Yeah. Ah, damn it. Just bring back some, you know, it's just tough, man. You know, just to witness our countless warriors, that sustained horrible injuries from, you know, IEDs, RPGs, and it's just the mangled bodies, burns, and just tubs of blood pouring out into warming. You know, they put the body bags on them to warm them so they can, as they bring them into the hospital there, I was in Kandahar. And it's just, you know, just the smell of death. But my team was, it was just a good team. That interdependence, I was able to, and I'll tell you, we didn't talk a lot about it, but it was the look that he would give me, or the touch on the back to say, hey, let's go have lunch, Sergeant Major, or let's go for a ride, Sergeant Major. Even our chaplain, you know, just would come down and say, hey, let's go flip some tires today, you know, to the command group. A lot of things didn't have to be said. Just a lot of stuff didn't have to be said. It was just the spirit of the caring, of the not spiritually, so to speak, but I don't know how to say it. It was just that aura, just the smell, just the you could just feel that the spirit of the caring to take care of each other. Yeah, we had a really great team in the 82nd for this last deployment here. Great group of paratroopers that knew their job, that was trained and proficient, that were ready to go out and die for our country, or, you know, to live for our country, all of it. We were ready to do that. You know, we had to go out of the gate quite a few times to, you know, do some business with locals and things like that. But overall, we not only protect and serve our country, we protect each other. If some of our fellow paratroopers are listening to this and was stationed at Fort Bragg with us in 82nd over there, the PSB, what they will remember about Martinez, we call Martinez Heavy Drop. Martinez was this big Hispanic, really tall. He had been about 6'2", 6'3", but he was, I would always get Martinez, you need to get over here for get take for the overweight program because you get a little too big, buddy. So he was this big dude. So we called him Heavy Drop because he had never landed softly on the drop zone. He barely would hit that drop zone. So that was his nickname, was Heavy Drop. And he was such a hard worker. He also had a thick accent. So two things right quick. So he was putting up the chain of command board. We had some new, some new personnel come in, and he was making sure the chain of command board was right. And back then, we just put him in some frames and put him up on the wall, all dressed right, dressed. And he was putting the frame up, and he spelled something wrong as he was putting it up, and it was supposed to be because of his accent, and it was supposed to be the honorable, whatever it was, the honorable Ken, whatever it was, right? And he put the horrible. So I said, it's his accent. So and we joked him about that. So then we started calling him the horrible. And then we have this strip of road and Fayetteville leading on to Fort Bragg, Fort Liberty. Now, leading on to Fort Bragg was called Yadkin Road, Y-A-D-K-I-N, Yadkin Road. And he would call it Yadkin. He just could not pronounce it well at all. So those were some of the funny moments about Staff Sergeant Martinez. He's missed dearly. For me, it was always at times when we were at our ramp ceremony. And our ramp ceremonies, we're on the tarmac, the aircraft tarmac, and our heroes who have, gave their life for our country. We're on the tarmac and we're, giving them the final salute to go back home to their family members. And that tarmac would be crowded. Soldiers would get up if we had to do it at we had to do it at 1 o'clock in the morning, 2 o'clock in the morning. It did not matter. People will come out of there if they had the night shift and they were, sleeping. They knew it was a ramp ceremony. They would come out to honor those soldiers who gave their lives for us, for our country, to honor them one last time from Kandahar as they went home to their family members. That to me, when you look around and you see a sea of people, and not just soldiers, civilians, retirees, because, it takes all of us to help this country. And you see a sea of people standing there at a proud salute or a hand over their heart. That's teamwork. It gets no better than that for me. It gets no better than taking care of people. It gets no better for me than seeing that love, and I can't forget it. It's embedded in my head. I've done it so many times. On behalf of the President of the United States Army, and a grateful nation, please accept this flag as a symbol of our appreciation for your loved ones' honor and faithful service. Never forget it. It's embedded in my memory. That is what this is. Although that's so tragic, we come together and we take care of each other. Interdependence for me is so important because, like I said earlier, being so fiercely independent almost cost me my life while I, at a point in some years ago. So teamwork it means a lot to me. I remember after redeploying, they sent most of the seniors to D.C., to the Pentagon. And I remember one day I was in my office at the Pentagon and I was looking out the window. And it was such a beautiful day. So I told my colleagues, some fellow soldiers and sergeant majors, sergeant major, hey, I'll be right back. I have to go take care of some stuff. So I go downstairs and I go in the parking garage. I get my car and I said, today is a great day to go for a swim. Now, I knew I couldn't swim, but I was going to drive my car off the bridge because I knew I couldn't swim and I knew I would drown. But my mental fortitude kicked in. And when I looked up, I was standing in front of the mental health counter at Fort Belvoir and saying, hey, I need some help. And during that entire drive, all I could think about was my two sons, Nuke and Bam. They're 37 and 32 now. And I tell you, I love those boys down to their bone marrow. And I did not want to leave a legacy of suicide. And it was 9 years. Like for 9 years, I suffered and went through, because now I needed to talk about this stuff that I had been dealing with and had suppressed. You know, I was diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder, anxiety, depression, military sexual trauma, you know, dealing with all of that. I was prescribed all kind of medications, from pain medication, antidepressant medication, just everything, just so many meds. And I was struggling. So, you know, I said, well, you know, try to get a job. I got a pretty darn good job, but I was still struggling. I was still struggling. So I resigned because, you know, it's lead, follow, or get the hell out the way. I've done enough leading. And now it's time for me to get the hell out of the way and let someone else come up and do better than I was able to do for that organization at that time. And I needed to concentrate on getting well mentally and getting back well, even more physically. It was tough. The transition for me, missing my team, that had a lot to do with it. Thinking about, you know, what am I going to do now after damn near 30 years in the Army? Trying to translate, yeah, while I was Adjutant General Corps Human Resources, I hadn't done that, oh my goodness, for 15, 17, 18, 20 years, I hadn't done that job. I was a paratrooper. How do I put paratrooper on my resume? You know, yeah, we can be translated for leadership and all that. So that part was tough, trying to translate what you do from the military to civilian terms. So that part of transition, trying to find employment, meaningful employment, that was pretty tough. So I just had to take some time for myself to get myself together and heal internally. While I was smiling on the outside, I was suffering on the inside. So I needed to heal internally. And I was able to do that through therapy, counseling, and that kind of stuff. And with the help of my two boys and with the program and organization that I'm a part of, Wounded Warrior Project. So I am grateful for that. A team. But my transition was not an easy transition. Now, some of that was my fault as well. You know, I didn't prepare as much as I should have prepared because I thought it would be a certain way. It wasn't, because although I worked hard in the military, I'm thinking, oh, I'm a command sergeant major. I'll just come out here and, you know, get this, you know, great job and come work for the, get me a good government job. Well, Tanya, you still have to put in the work and do a resume and all that kind of stuff as well. Yeah, so yeah, it's some of that I have to take accountability for, you know, because it was not tough, meaning that the resources and things weren't available for me, because they were. It was just tough on my part because I wasn't fully where I needed to be mentally to go out and pursue something meaningful. So I'm glad, you know, that I took that break and was able to work for a little while and, you know, realize that I needed to resign and step out of the way and just wait a little bit. And then now I have something that's really fulfilling to me that I'm taking care of. Back again, serving, not in uniform in that way, but still being able to serve and help veterans and help warriors. And that's with Wounded Warrior Project. Initially, no, I didn't have those doubts about the VA. When I went in, you know, trying to figure out, you know, what benefits, if any, that I'm authorized or entitled to, they helped me out. I mean, they put me in the right direction. It's not an easy process. It's not so streamlined and so smooth. There are some bumps in the roads. There are some wait periods and there are some timelines. No fault of my own, and sometimes no fault of the representative that may be helping you. It has to go through different levels. And I think just, you know, I had to understand that and not necessarily accept that, but just kind of deal with it and follow up and that kind of thing. It's not an easy process, but it can be done. You know, again, and I'll mention Wounded Warrior Project. I'll mention some other organizations that are out there that could help soldiers with their benefits or help them navigate the VA to a point where they can get the help that they deserve or get the treatment that they deserve. Yeah, it's not easy, but it can be done. And the VA sometimes gets a bad rap, and I don't know, not for me. I appreciate it. There's still some improvement. Hell, there's still some improvement I need to do for me. You know, I'm still growing, right? Even though I've dug my feet down deep into the soil and that, but I still got some growing to do. And I think for the most part, they are improving. I know they're doing a lot of work on women's initiatives and things like that and different things that, you know, women need that you know, sometimes that men may not need. I mean, it's a male dominated world. That's just the way it is. And so, yeah, I can understand how, you know, since we're talking about the VA, how some things were catered toward men because men were the war fighters. Men, you know, they did a lot of stuff. And then when the females start coming in, it's just taking some time to get what we need in the system, whether it's gynecological care, whether it's a mental health care, a different kind of way. Men and women are different. Men think one way and women think a different way. My boyfriend is an Army Ranger. Totally different mindset, than I may have or something. So we all deal with things a little bit different, but they are improving. And I do appreciate the VA for improving. And, you know, with Wounded Warrior Project and other veteran service organizations out there advocating for veterans and warriors for the things that we need to help us out to be better and to get healthier and to live the life that we deserve, you know. I do like now it's such a beautiful day. I'm like, oh man, the winds are calm and it would be a great day to jump. Yeah, I do. I do miss that. I miss it a lot. Although I do tell my friends, I have a saying, you know, I'm so damn retired. Like I love my life. I love being retired, but I do miss that. You know, just, you know, whether we're riding in the vehicles, going to the drop zone or all of us on the aircraft, you know, and the Air Force mapping the earth and or different things. I miss that a lot. I miss, you know, our runs together. I miss training together. I miss, you know, just going in the dining facility, serving soldiers during the holidays. I do miss that. I miss my team, just like I, you know, and I hear some retirees, so I don't miss nothing about it. Well, I miss them just like my mom passed over 30, almost 40 years ago. I still miss her sometimes, you know? So yeah, I do. I miss that. You know, I pride myself on being a pretty darn good leader, but I had to learn a lot to be a successful leader because when I was a young soldier and then coming in the military, I had the big head. You couldn't tell me nothing. I knew it all. You know, I was a little old country girl, you know, grew up poor, but I was hardcore. You know, I was physically and mentally strong. I was tough, but I thought leadership was something totally different than what it really is. I thought that leadership, my idea of being a successful leader back then as a young soldier coming in, a little wee paratrooper, not even paratrooper because I figured it out before then, but as a young soldier, probably I was what, about 27, 20 something. Maybe probably when I was on the trail, I had to figure as a drill sergeant, say trail. When I was a drill sergeant, I think maybe that was around the time it was my aha moment, because I thought successful leadership meant that everybody else was down here at the bottom and I was up here on the top. But that was not success. That's not successful leadership. That's sickness. Like, I had to really learn to let the air out of my big head and learn that leadership was about influencing people, inspiring people, motivating people, and getting the best out of people. Yeah. So, and then once I figured that out and said, hey, this is what leadership is about, and this is what you have to do. It's about, you know, taking care of people. And again, you know, excelling in my career and making it to the top. Yeah, I just, you know, put my head down and dug my feet in and tried to strive for my max potential. You know, and I think a lot of times that most life forms, whether it's plants or whatever, they strive for the max, except some people. And I'm glad I figured that out, because when I look at it, you say, well, how tall can a tree grow? Well, a tree strives for its max. It grows as tall and as high as possible. They don't grow, trees don't grow half, but sometimes I think people only do half. And I wanted to strive to the max. And I was able to do that because I had the dignity of choice, again, my drive and discipline to be able to do that. And I think, you know, we get stuck sometimes and we think that we have to repeat the same thing we did last year, and we don't. We can tear up last year's plan and we can develop a new plan. We can do something different. So, you know, just leadership and in the military, I've learned to take the good, the failures, and the rewards. And like I said earlier, as I reflect positive back on the military, it really provided me a chance to become stronger and just more reliable for life.
That was Command Sergeant Major Tanya Oxendine. To learn more about her and the Wounded Warrior Project, click the link in the show description. Thanks for listening to Warriors in Their Own Words. If you have any feedback, please email the team at kharbaugh@evergreenpodcasts.com. We're always looking to improve the show. And if you enjoyed this episode, don't forget to rate and review. Warriors in Their Own Words is a production of Evergreen Podcasts in partnership with The Honor Project. Our producer is Declan Roars. Bridget Coyne is our production director, and Sean Ruhlhoffman is our audio engineer. Special thanks to Evergreen executive producers Joan Andrews, Michael DeAloya, and David Moss. I'm Ken Harbaugh, and this is Warriors in Their Own Words.
A news story gets shared by a friend on social media, or you catch a tweet that really makes your blood boil. But how do you separate fact from fiction? That's the premise behind Disinformation, a 10-part series from Evergreen Podcasts and Emergent Risk International coming this fall. Tune into Disinformation wherever you get your podcasts, and remember, don't believe everything you read.